much for coming to New Hope's anniversary. Thank you very much for putting up with us, the heat and the crowd. This year we did not seem to have near as many problems as we've had in years gone by, but the meeting isn't over yet. It's been my privilege to introduce Clancy. I've known Clancy for some time now. And one of the things that my sponsor told me when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you're going to see winners in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you should follow the winners. I had the privilege of being out at Clancy's house one Saturday not too long ago, and I watched him playing volleyball. He was playing volleyball on a team that won every game, so he continued to play all afternoon. I watched him play and pitch on a baseball team in the morning, and his team won the game. Clancy I is truly a winner, not only in the sports world, but more important, he's a winner in the Association of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's a fellow who has helped many, many people in personal contacts, and he also has helped many people through his TAPE program. I think we'll all be very fortunate and enjoy Clancy I from Venice, California.
My name is Clancy Imeslund, and I'm an alcoholic. I appreciate all those nice things Bill said, but years ago my sponsor told me that when you really become wonderful, you need not say anything because you somehow become celestially illuminated. And I don't know what he meant by that, but everybody's so goddamn cute down here, I caught it. But I'm glad to be here tonight for the New Hope 10th anniversary. I've been here several years. I was supposed to be here last year, and they found a tumor in my throat, and they took it out, and it turned out to be benign, but I couldn't be at New Hope. So with every illness, there's a plus side. I didn't get a chance to come down and see Bill Roop screw up the food line one more year. But it's a nice occasion, the 10th anniversary, and I'm sure there's a lot of new people here. Apparently there are a lot of chips out tonight. What are you laughing at, Pat? Anything that you've heard recently? Just but there are a lot of new people here tonight. And I want you folks to know, I know that it's very warm in here, and in your summer dresses and your open-neck shirts, I notice you're fanning yourself. And someday when you become truly spiritual, you turn your inner thermostat to cool, put on your shirt and coat and tie, and stay comfortable forever. But I'm sure that you're like me. When I came to AA, I thought AA had been here forever. And if you're new tonight, or if you're here for your first few days or weeks or months, I'm sure you feel that AA's been here forever. And it sometimes seems like it is. There's old-timers and decrepit old pukes like I and other people and many, all kinds of people here. And it's kind of interesting. I think on a 10th anniversary, and because this, I've been thinking about it a little bit about this year for some reason or other, that what a remarkable thing this is. I don't want to keep you here all night, but I want to spend a few minutes on something that you may not think about very often. And if you're new, you maybe haven't thought about it at all. But that is this. You know something? This may be the only meeting in the history of the world where the speaker is going to wear sunglasses. It's very wonderful to be here at the... Well... But they've traced alcohol, the usage of alcohol, back at least about 5,000 years, back to Babylonian, Sumer, and Mid-Eastern cities. And as the years have gone by, every civilization has used alcohol, and for the most part, wisely. But in every civilization where they've had any adequate record, there's always some mention made of a small percentage of people within that civilization who uses alcohol badly, who reacts differently to it, who acts funny when they drink. And nobody ever can figure out why. And years ago, they thought they were possessed by the devil. Then they thought they were just evil people. Then they thought they were thoughtless people. Then they thought they were had the curse, some terrible God's curse. And in fact, even today in Irish families, they talk, they euphemistically say, yes, Uncle Pat, he had the curse. The curse that afflicts people, nobody knows why. But they've been working on identifying and locating and curing this curse for 5,000 years now. Because it's bothered and killed people for 5,000 years, made people mad. And the funny thing about that is this, in my lifetime, now I'm kind of old, but I'm not that old. In my lifetime, when I was a little boy playing softball and football in Wisconsin, there was a family in the East who had a very nice son, and they were very wealthy, and he was one of these people who suffered from this curse that no one could understand. And they were willing to do anything they could to help their little boy. So they found the best doctor in the world and sent him there with an open checkbook saying, spend whatever you have to spend, but straighten out our little boy. Whatever it takes, $1 million, straighten out our little boy. And he went over to this great doctor, famous doctor in Switzerland, entered his clinic, stayed there a whole year. The doctor worked on him physically and mentally and got him together again, got him to see the under nature of his problem, released him, and within a month, the boy was back at the door again, being carried, dead, drunk, sick and desperate, no reason for it. And they sobered him up one more time, and the family said, please help our little boy, whatever it takes. And the doctor called the young man in, his name is Roland. He said, Roland, I have to apologize to you. He said, I was under the impression I could help you. I thought I did. But now for the first time I realize the nature of your problem. You are what is known as an alcoholic. I didn't know that before. He said, I thought you had a personality disorder. But you are what is known as an alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no help available to you in the world today. And that was in the early 1930s. The best doctor in the world had never heard of a treatment that worked for alcoholics. That's kind of scary. And he said, Roland, I think there's two things you got to do. You got to understand. You either are going to drink intermittently till you die or go insane, or else you must either voluntarily or involuntarily keep yourself self-confined so you can't get at it, because you will lose whatever power you have. Now, this, I'm sure Roland didn't like that diagnosis very much. If I'd have been him, I'd have asked for a second opinion. And probably the doctor would have said, okay, you're homely too. What do you think of that? But he said, is there nothing else? And the doc said, well, one in a million people like you, maybe one in 5 million, somehow have some sort of involuntary, major psychological revision that no one can understand. Those people call it a spiritual experience, but nobody knows how to get it. Sometimes people in church get it. Sometimes people who never go to church get it. He says your chances are just about as good of being hit by lightning as you will of having a spiritual experience. And Roland was a little distressed by this, but he got on a ship and came home. And I'll tell you something. He believed the doctor. He believed the doctor. He did something on that ship because he believed the doctor that you and I continue to try to do many years later. He surrendered to the fact that he was helpless and hopeless. He surrendered to the fact there was no way to beat it. And he came back to New York. And he didn't like church as much. But there was kind of a semi-religious therapeutic available at the time. It's kind of like a religious est of a sort. It was called the Oxford Movement, where upper class people or middle class people went to find to hone their spiritual values. And he went there. As he wrote later, the only reason he went, he wanted to see if he could stay sober a while so his parents would have a pleasant memory of him when he died drunk. Which is funny, but it's terribly sad. And he stayed sober, and he thought it was due to the Oxford Movement. But I don't think it was, because the Oxford Movement was full of people trying to stay, not a full of, a lot of them trying to stay sober, and they couldn't. I think it was he stayed sober because he had somehow, without knowing it, surrendered on that ship. But he stayed sober a while. And his folks were pleased. Now, what's that got to do with you and me being here today? 10th anniversary of the New Hope Group. There's a connection. Because his parents were pleased that he was sober. And they wanted to give him a reward. They said, "You've done so well, Roland. We're so proud. Dr. Jung must have cured you." But he knew he hadn't. But they didn't want to hurt his feelings. He said, "Why don't you take a little vacation? Go up to Vermont this summer. Get away from it all. Spend a month at our expense. Whenever you want to go." So he just took a time at random and went to Vermont for a while. And that saved your life and mine. That trip. And the timing of it was exquisite. If he'd have gone a month earlier than he'd gone, you and I would be dead or insane tonight. If he had gone a month later than he did, you and I would be dead or insane tonight. But instead he went at just the right time. And he got there and he's staying around there, and some friend he had said, "We have a local drunk who's just terrible. Could you tell him about the Oxford Movement?" So he said, "Sure." He went over and called on this guy, a guy named Ebby. And he told Ebby about the Oxford Movement. And Ebby didn't want to hear it. Screw it. And a week later, Ebby went on one of his terrible drunks, drove his car into somebody's house, was arrested, taken to jail. The next day, he was being sentenced to the Vermont State Penitentiary because they'd put him on probation several times. This was it. Enough of his crap. But Roland happened to still be there. So he thought it would be a nice gesture. He went over to that court because he happened to be in town. And said, "Judge, I've met this man and I've tried to help him. And I think I can help him, but I'll have to get him to New York. Would you release him in my custody and I'll take him to New York and put him in my Oxford Movement?" The judge says, "Okay, I know your family and you're very reputable. I'll give him in your custody, but if he comes back to Vermont, he's going to the penitentiary." So, Ebby was taken to New York and put in the Oxford Movement. He didn't want to be in the Oxford Movement, but he didn't want to be in the Vermont State Penitentiary either. So now we got two people in our chain. One who wanted to stay sober a while so his folks would have a pleasant memory of him. One who wanted to stay out of the Vermont State Penitentiary. Now, why was it necessary for the New Hope Group to have Ebby in New York? I'll tell you why. Because when he got in the Oxford Movement, they started grinding him. "You must carry our four absolutes to someone else." And he didn't want to carry them to anybody else. It's embarrassed enough to be there, for Christ's sake. But he happened to think. There was a kid. Roland never heard of him. But Ebby remembered a kid that he used to get drunk with in Vermont. And he was in New York somewhere. So we got a hold of somebody in Vermont, found out where he was. And he looked up this guy in the Brooklyn phone book and found him. This drunken puke named Bill Wilson. And if he hadn't been able to find him, you and I would have been dead tonight. And he came over and called on Bill Wilson. Didn't want him, but he wanted to look good to his friends. So he told Bill about the Oxford Movement and the four absolutes. And Bill responded with the same enthusiasm that you or I would have, you know. "That's really wonderful, Ebby. Would you hand me that six-pack off the buffet there?" And this hurt Ebby's feelings. So he left again and came back in 2 weeks, and he had the official Oxford Group closer with him. "Tell
you want to do? Tell you about God.
And Bill Wilson, like you or me, then, oh, shit. And when he left, Bill Wilson went on one of the worst drunks of his life. That's how he responded. We understand that. And he had a... It isn't in our literature much, but it's in some of the... It's kind of, that last drunk, it was wonderful. He wound up in a mission over in Manhattan where Ebby lived, denouncing everybody and everything. Just terrible, crazy son of a bitch. And he woke... Got stuck him in Towns Hospital finally. And he woke up one morning sobering up, sick. And it turned out this guy was the one in a million or one in 5 million in his generation who had a spiritual experience. As he wrote later, it's as though a big light filled the room and there was a wind going through my head. And he something had terribly changed. He didn't know what it was. Now, he got out of there and that began your life and mine. But why do you think it was necessary for Ebby to call on him? I'll tell you why. Because most people who had a spiritual experience ran to the church and got active in church work. He somehow connected it with Ebby and stopping drinking. And he ran to Ebby and the Oxford movement and joined the Oxford movement. Only he didn't join the Oxford movement to find God. He joined the Oxford movement because he felt that somehow he'd been given a way to help alcoholics. So now we got three people. Somebody staying sober long enough to their family will like him. One who's staying out of the Vermont State Penitentiary, and some crazy goof that's going to cure alcoholics by touching them. And this Bill Wilson spent the next 6 months going to Oxford group meetings, and he worked with drunken people every day and every night. He'd find them in bars. He'd find them on street corners. He'd say, come on, I'm going to tell you about how to stay sober. And he took them home. And he had a lot of time to do it. He couldn't hold a job. His wife was working. That always worked good in our family. Might as well work in his. But he worked with people. He took them home, had them stay the night. Most of them would get drunker as a result. Stole stuff out of his house. He'd take these drunken fools to Oxford group meetings. And the people in the Oxford group, you know, they were kind of yuppies of their day. They weren't very thrilled to have some guy sitting next to them puking on their shoe, you know. I hope you'll find God soon, son. You just vomited on my shoe. And old Bill Wilson did this for 6 months. And one day, he just struck him. This is not working. And he turned to his wife. He said, I'm kidding myself. I thought something dramatic had happened to me. Nothing happened to me. I've been working with drunken people every day and night for 6 months, and not one person has stayed sober. Not one person has stayed sober. I might as well do some other kind of work. This isn't working. And his wife turned to him, and she said something. Right then, our life hung by a thread. Not funny. Very, very serious. She turned to him and gave maybe the only answer that would have saved your life and mine. And she didn't even realize she was doing it. She changed his whole perception. I was talking to her years later in Hartford, Connecticut. I said, Lois, how did you ever think of that answer? What an inspiring answer. It was like God put the words in your mouth. She didn't seem inspired to me. It just seemed so obvious. I couldn't understand why he didn't see it. What she said when he said, it doesn't work, not one person is staying sober. She said, of course it's working, Bill. You have never stayed sober 6 months. He said, that's right. Maybe it's in trying to help people you stay sober. That's how you stay sober. And you all know the story after that, mostly. He finally got, somebody took a chance and gave him a job out to Akron, Ohio for a proxy battle. He went out there. The proxy thing blew up. And he was screwed again. And he came back into his hotel, hot spring day, in the Mayflower Hotel. I'm kind of a romanticist. I like to live in great moments secondarily. A few years ago, I stood in the Mayflower Hotel on a hot day, about where he must have stood, and thinking, my one chance of getting back in business is blown. He had $10 in his pocket. Not even enough to catch a train back to New York. Has to call up his wife and say, I failed again. You can't leave your job. Everything is going to hell. And as you stand in that lobby over there, about 15 feet is a little door, as they have in small town hotels. And over it is a little red neon sign saying, cocktails. And I was been sober a long time, but just thinking about that, I looked at that sign and my tongue went... And I'll tell you, you and I came very close to not being in the New Hope anniversary right then. He started towards the bar and then thought, well, he had promised he would call someone. And over on this side of the lobby is a little couple telephones in the church directory above it. And they went over there. And he called, made a few calls. What some people, it isn't in our literature because he was too nice to say it, but it's quite well known. A number of people hung up on him before he got a call through. By the time he got a call through, he'd made several calls. And if that had been me, or maybe you, well, I've made my call, and the dirty son of a bitch hung up on me. Cocktail! But he hung in there, and he finally got a hold of some minister who had a wealthy parishioner who had a drunken doctor. And they got together. And they sat down and talked. And the doctor said, I wish you could stay with me a while. I don't know if I'm strong enough to make it. And Bill didn't have any way to get out of town. So he says, okay. So he moved in with this drunken doctor. Sober doctor. And this doctor was a spiritual leader in the Oxford group. Could not stay sober, which indicates Oxford group didn't keep people sober. But he stayed there and they talked Oxford group spiritual understandings for 2 weeks. The doctor now felt better. He decided to go to the AMA convention in Atlantic City and tell the other doctors that he had found a guy that could help him stay sober. And 4 days later, Bill had stayed at his home with his wife and kids. And the office nurse called up about 8 o'clock in the morning. Said, Mrs. Smith, I'm so heartsick to tell you this, but I got a call this morning from the railroad station. Two porters carried the doctor off the train so drunk he couldn't walk. And he's face down on the floor of the office. What can I do? And one more time, your life and I hung by a little thread, boy. But Bill and Ann Smith went down and got him and brought him home. And they worked on him, gave him junk and syrup and... primitive ways they got people sober then. At the end of 3 days, the doctors suddenly came to, and he was sober. He said, oh, God. He says, I didn't know what day it was, but I have to do a surgery at 1 o'clock. He was a surgeon. He said, the person got cancer of the colon, and only I can do the surgery, and I can't make my hand stop. What can I do for God's sakes? I got to do that surgery. And his sponsor did something for him that... I knew that story years later, and I tried to get my sponsor to do it for me. And he wouldn't. Bill Wilson went down and got his baby a drink so he could steady his hand down so he could do the surgery. And the doctor never had another drink. And that was the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous, as they figure it. It was just this month. It's appropriate you have your birthday in June. That was June 10th, 1935. And... something changed. They began to realize sitting around talking about spiritual values didn't keep people sober. It's helping people. So they descended on some poor boob up in the Akron hospital, defenseless. He was a lawyer who lived in Akron but had come from Kentucky. He had been under a lot of pressure for his drinking, his wife and everybody else. I heard him talk years ago. He said, I was laying in that bed in Akron, Ohio, and my wife came in and said, two men wanted to talk to me about my drinking. And I thought, oh, hell. But them two fellas came in, and the damnedest thing, they never talked to me once about my drinking. They talked to me about their drinking and how they felt. And I never heard anybody describe me before. He says, now I was so impressed. When I got out of that hospital, I wanted to stick with them fellers, and I've been with them ever since. AA number 3 in the chain. Now, the three of those descend on some other poor boob named Ernie. Ernie was a nice guy. In fact, he married Dr. Bob's daughter eventually. Which is a touching thing, isn't it? AA number four married his sponsor's daughter. Tomorrow, I understand, there's some sort of a coronation for Mr. Pat here. 27 years. I remember going through that phase. It was a big one. I can't stay over because I have to preside over my grandson's birthday tomorrow afternoon. And the reason made me think about that is because this grandson is the child of my daughter and a guy I sponsor. He was sober 5 years when he and my daughter got going together. They got married. Now they have three children, doing well, very well. But I'll give you a definition of mixed emotions. Watching your daughter go down the aisle with someone whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything and break the sanctity of the fifth step, but you can give clues like, let me know if he brings home any sheep, honey. Little things. And Ernie had a problem too, because he married his sponsor's daughter, and he didn't have to be quite so involved as the other boobs around there. And he kind of returned to his old ways, and he eventually got drunk and died. That's what happens to people who don't do it, no matter who you're married to. But these guys worked with people incessantly from now on. Some of you may have met or heard an old Dr. Bob had a son. He had a son and a daughter. His son, Bob Smith Jr., who was now about 68, but then was a 17-year-old boy living in his household. And I said to him one time, I said, in fact, he's the one who drove his father out to meet Bill Wilson. If you ever hear a touching, he talks sometimes, he says, I'm the only one still alive who watched Dr. Bob meet Bill Wilson. Touching. But anyway, I said, it must have been wonderful for you living in that house with the beginning of the greatest spiritual movement of the 20th century, and here you are present, that must have just made you tingle. He said, no. So I thought it was kind of crappy a lot, most of the time. I was glad to see my dad sober, but he was periodic. He was sober a lot of the time anyway. This guy from New York was nice, but he's a little intense for my taste. But he said, you know, I was a senior in high school. You could never bring anybody home from school. There's always some drunk on the sofa, and a house smelled like formaldehyde. They're just hideous. He said, I just wished it had never happened at that time. Well, God punished him for his evil attitude. That young man never drank. Never drank. Years later, he married an alcoholic and is now in Al-Anon. So it's been my feeling that God overreacted. But now they're getting along. They have a little pocket of people in Akron. Bill goes back to New York after 3 months, and it starts to grow, little by little. A few people here and there. Most of them got drunk, but some of them stayed. And by 1938, they decided to write a book about it, so that at least they'd have some remembrance of what had worked. And they wrote this, Bill Wilson wrote this very book that we read from tonight at length. In fact, there's only a couple pages they didn't read. I think it's over here. One page and To the Wives. And this book, it's just about the way it was written. Very, very few changes since then. And as a result of this book, it started to grow a little bit more. Now, it's a common thing in AA and has been for many, many years. Anyone with more than a sixth grade education can say things like, well, I came to AA and they wanted me to read this book. I thought it was a badly written book. Well, I'll tell you, I'm a writer. I've been a writer all my adult life. I started off as a sports writer after the Second World War, and I got into advertising and public relations and radio and television, and I made a good living writing. I don't do it now. As most of you know, I run a mission in the middle of Skid Row. But I'm still a writer, because at Christmas and Easter every year, I write a letter to the citizens of Los Angeles. Now, I'm not saying I'm a good writer, but I don't dare proofread it, because every time I proofread it, I write another check. That's good writing. You see, every time I proofread it, I write another check. You see. Come up and get your one-day chip, you dummy. Anyway. And I never thought this was a badly written book. I never thought it was a bad... First time I read it was a long time ago. I thought it was a mediocrely written book. The big problem in the AA book to me always was, it never gets anywhere. I write things that say, do it now. Send in your money. Fill out the coupon. Buy now. It's ready. Go. Not this is the...
If you're at this stage of a development...
You can read for days and never get anywhere.
A chapter to the wise.
It's hard not to jump right to the stories. This is a nice book for people who are kind of type B's or something, but intense intellectual people need something a little more dynamic. Well, I went to AA off and on for a few years, but I had to get into deeper things. I got into psychoanalysis and metaphysics and read great philosophers. Some years later, through a series of bad breaks, I was on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And I walked off Skid Row and went back to that stinking AA. And they made me read the book again. And I've been reading it ever since. And somewhere over the past few years, must be 10 or 15 years ago now, I've came to a conclusion I didn't even realize. But I'll tell you about it today without fear of contradiction. Somewhere in the last few years, I've come to the belief that the book Alcoholics Anonymous is the only book, or maybe one of two, but the only book I have ever held in my hand that I believe to be truly divinely inspired. Now, you might say, why would that be? Another one of these people who see miracles behind every bush, you know. Don't you hate it when you go to a meeting and people say, I had another miracle this morning. The sun came up. Ah. Oh. I have a tendency to nod off. I'm not easily swayed by miraculous things. I am much too slick for that. But I've come to believe this book is miraculous for two reasons. One, it is the only book dealing with human emotions and the human spirit and the celestial spirit that gets truer every year. Year after year, it gets truer the longer you stay sober. Most books, you know, Modern Man in Search of a Soul and Man Against Himself and all these books on Est and TA and TM, they all do good for a while, but in a few months they kind of... And you have to do something else. If you stay around here, this book gets truer and truer and truer. I still once a year read for a month in a book study in our group. And I still read things that I never saw before. And I read, because when you read aloud, you can't skim. You got to read it. I think, God damn it, that's smart. Where was that in 1949? You know. That's one reason. The other reason that's equally important. The man who wrote it did not know enough to write it. I'll guarantee you that. Here's a guy 2.5 years sober, 3 years sober when it came out. Call him 3 years sober. Give him the edge. Had no background in medicine, no background in psychology, no background in abnormal psychology, no background in nothing. And he wrote a book that has altered more alcoholic lives than all other therapies combined in the last 5,000 years. Now that is some kind of goddamn miracle. If you are new tonight, or in your first few months, or first year, you might think to yourself, well, a guy 3 years sober, sure, he should know enough to write a book. You will come to discover when you are 3 years sober, you are not as smart as you thought you were going to be. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just kind of patronize people 3 years sober. Still going to meetings, Jimmy? Keep it up. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Was that two sugars and one cream or two creams and one? Never mind, I'll do it myself. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. Nothing personal against them, just want to see how they turn out. And here's a guy, 2.5 years sober, wrote a book that has changed more lives than any, all combination of all therapies combined. And today, of course, when the book came out, then they got some juice and liberty, and then I started doing posts, and people come in, and people can't stay sober, and some people got drunk, and some stayed sober. And today they estimate there's 1.5 million sober alcoholics in the world, sober. Some of you were at Montreal in 1985, sat in a football stadium, the Olympic Stadium, saw more sober people together in one place than in anywhere in the history of the world. And that was only just a fingernail of AA. And on and on. So you and I are very fortunate people tonight at the 10th anniversary of the New Hope. You and I are living in the only era in the history of mankind where it is not necessary to go mad or die drunk if you're an alcoholic. Briefly in the 1840s in the Washingtonians, but they all died drunk finally. But here you don't have to. Just stop and think. You and I are living in the little less than 1% of human history where there's a place to go. Just think, up till recently, there was no place to go, even if you wanted to go. People cry out in desperation, I'll do anything. You'd have as much luck. I sometimes think about this. Think what you could do if you could go into a terminal cancer ward. Say, hey, you people dying, would you be willing to go to a meeting every night for 90 days and do some things I tell you if I got rid of this cancer? Christ, they would crawl and kiss your feet. If you go to an AIDS ward, we have some in Los Angeles, I guess some everywhere now, but these guys dying and there's no way out, say, would you be willing to take some steps and write an inventory and things like that to get rid of this AIDS? They would beg and cry. We are living in an era where a solution is now available to people with another deadly disease, where it is no longer necessary for people like us to die drunk, to go mad, or to keep yourself locked up. So aren't we lucky? You don't see alcoholic deaths anymore. There's only one sad thing about this whole fact. Today, with all the help available, Alcoholics Anonymous is available everywhere. In Los Angeles, in our new meeting list, we have 2,200 meetings a week in Los Angeles. And they're all over. Southern California's got more AAs in it than any three states. And there's all over Atlanta. They're all over everywhere. If you're not quite ready to go to AA, if you're too sensitive, you can be eased in through a treatment center. If you have no insurance, there are counselors behind every bush. Yeah. But it's really not necessary to die drunk. Today, with all the help available in America, it is estimated that 95 out of 100 alcoholics die drunk today. Can you imagine that? I'll tell you something more shocking than that. A number of people in this room tonight who are sober and happy will die drunk. Isn't that hideous? How can that be, for God's sake? I don't know who's going to be. Might be me. Might be you. Because it isn't really predicated on how you're feeling tonight. It's predicated on somewhere up ahead, when a crunch comes, how you have maintained your spiritual condition when things were okay. The man who taught me that, my first sponsor, I said, we're not going to die drunk. He said, somebody might. They do. And a few years later, he died drunk. He pointed out with his life, he was right. Now, why do people die drunk? Now you say, they don't really die drunk, do they? I'll tell you something. Today, I see people dying of alcoholism every day. When I say die, I don't mean die figuratively. I mean die where we put a blanket over their face and get them out of there, to the morgue. I see people going over the edge into irreversible brain damage. And you say, of course, Clancy, you're in the middle of Skid Row. That's natural. But the people who die on Skid Row are only 3% of alcoholic deaths. The other 97% of people are people like you and me. Just like us. And you say, why do people die, for Christ's sake? When I first went to that mission, I was going to go down there for a few months as a kind of a lark. I've been there going on 14 years now. But when I first went there, I knew I could get people off that goddamn street because I'd been on that street. And I'd tell them about AA and I'd help them. And I'd grab guys and say, hey, you don't have to die, pal. I got a way to go. Come on with me. And I never had any luck at all. They would come, but they wouldn't stay sober. And I tried this again and again. I thought, why don't these people accept it? They're dying. You go to the L.A. County Hospital to have an AA meeting there. You can't get people in the alcoholic ward to go to an AA meeting. They're laying in beds with their liver out to here and their eyeballs yellow. And they're, I'm not really an alcoholic, I have other problems. You go back next month, they're dead, and there's new people in the bed saying the same thing. Why is that? Why is that? And then it suddenly struck me, for the same reason that I slipped for years, and the same reason people can't make it here, and the same reason people slip, and the same reason that people who don't take care of AA after they're sober eventually slip again. And it isn't any big thing. It's a small thing, apparently. But it's present in every alcoholic I've ever known. And the only question is, if you let it become important, it'll kill you. You got to find some way to reduce it so it isn't as big as you think it is. What do you think that factor is that makes alcoholics impervious to recovery? Just this. What you say is true, but my case is different. That's all it takes. And you're dead. And there isn't a person in this room who doesn't have that feeling at gut level, but my case really is different. Now, we all got the feeling. The question is, what do we do to keep it diminished so it doesn't become a paramount belief? All you have to do is think your case is different and let it run away with you. If you can believe that your case is different, you will be impervious to any data or information. If you ever wonder why people you're trying to help, that you can't get the message through, because if they got that wall up, there's nothing you can say or do that's going to help. Yes, what you say is true. Boy, that's certainly right. But down deep, your stomach says, but you don't understand me. My case is different. Now, I look at my life. Why did I go from being an executive to being a Skid Row bum? And I had some of the best AAs in the world trying to be my sponsors and help me. In town after town. And they took me to their meetings and they took me to these things and they talked to me for hours. And I'll tell you, sometimes I wanted to be with them, but the wall is there. But my case is different. You see, alcohol isn't really my problem. It is. It looks like it is. And I use it as a defense. But I have other things. I look over my life. All of my life I have felt, much of my life, I have felt different. I've examined myself a lot of times. And I'm sure like other people, I felt different. I've examined and saw in myself things like, I'm too sensitive to things. I overreact. I have too much anxiety somehow. I'm very anxiety prone, and other people aren't. I can tell by looking at them. I have feelings of insecurity that other people don't seem to have. I feel when I get a good job, I feel they're going to find me out somehow. I don't even know what they're going to find out, but nothing is ever good, it seems like. I get lonely sometimes. I know everybody gets lonely, but when they get lonely, they call up somebody. When I get lonely, I get so goddamn depressed, I can't bear to see anybody. I just want to stay in bed and pull the covers over my head. And that's hard to explain to people, you know. What are you doing there on the bed this morning with the covers over your head? I'm lonely. But of course you're lonely. You're under the covers all by yourself. And as I looked over my years, my life, you know what disturbs me most about these kind of feelings and other feelings like them? They are wimp feelings. I hate wimp feelings. At least if I'm going to have feelings, let them be macho feelings. Let them be manly feelings, for Christ's sake, not wimp feelings. You can't even talk about them. You know? I just think, how would you do if you're going through life and so your boss says, "How are you doing today, son?" "Oh, I'm afraid." "Well, what are you afraid of?" "Beat the shit out of me." Yeah. You learn early on those are not the correct answers. The correct answers are like, "How you doing?" "I'm fine." "Fine." And you keep people from finding out you're a wimp. There are all sorts of defenses people use. I never knew it. But I've used most of them. If you're read more than one book, you can at times have an intellectual defense, you know. Is that the way it seems to you? Obviously, you never read Nietzsche on that subject, did you? Or you can be slick. "I'm just feeling good, man. What's coming on down? I don't need that reality shit, man. I've got it together." Or, "I've got a new Harley and I'm going to drive it up your ass." Thousands of defenses. But the problem is, down deep, I'm a wimp. And I went to psychoanalysis and I went to metaphysics, and I discovered as a boy on a ship in the Pacific early in the Second World War, a few drinks fills up my wimp holes. And that's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because when I drink, it seems to me, it just brings me up to where they've been all along. It makes me secure and I get along. I'm not so easily rejected. God, that's terrible to be so sensitive to rejection that when you're feeling bad, just a glance can ruin your whole day. When my holes are filled, I don't get rejected. I reject. What a difference that is for a wimp. I'm sure some of you guys have watched that miracle happen late at night in a bar. Sit there and watch a literal miracle happen as you have a few drinks and watch an old beast become beautiful by closing time. And I might sidle over to such an old queen and imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. Would you like to join me in the old Chevy? Now, if she'd say, "Now, when my holes are filled, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. You know, too bad, bitch. Don't come begging tomorrow." If that would happen to me in one of my wimp stages, I'd go in the washroom and hang myself. That's the difference. Drinking has just been things that redress my emotional imbalance. And the only problem I've ever had, and I mention it again and again, I have an unfortunate tendency to overfill my holes. And I seem to have no runoff mechanism. It goes right to the electrical works. And a new change takes place. and I become what judges and policemen call bizarre. Now, there's nothing wrong with being bizarre when you're a kid, you know. Boy, did we have fun last night after the prom. I peed in the hotel lobby. But as you get older, being bizarre gets to be a significant handicap. And I was married and had children and trying to hold jobs, and it really gets to be hideous. So you try stopping drinking. I went to AA at my first meeting in 1949. AA was only 14 years old. I thought I'd been there for 10,000 years already. I thought the guys there had been there 10,000 years already. They just sat around in a circle. As I remembered it, it looked like God's waiting room, just waiting for some voice to say, next. But they talked about their trouble with drinking and how when they stopped drinking, it felt wonderful. So I stopped drinking. And I didn't feel wonderful. Just the holes came back, that's all. I felt ill at ease, too sensitive, inadequate, lonely, afraid. So most of my life, those years, were spent trying to fill the holes without overfilling them, never knowing that it's an impossibility. Sooner or later, it must explode. And I wound up on Skid Row, and I'll tell you, the last day I spent a day drinking. On Skid Row in Los Angeles, my family gone, my children gone, my career gone, my home gone, my clothing gone, my front teeth gone. You know, you can get new families and careers, but like our book says, we are like men who have lost our front teeth. We never grow new ones, or whatever it says. And if a guy would have come along and put a lie detector in my arm and said, are you an alcoholic? I would have said, no, I'm not. Not really. And that needle wouldn't have quivered a 16th of an inch because I was dying and my case was different and I'd been to AA for 9 years and I'd been in psychoanalysis and I'd been everywhere. And one morning, it was raining and I stood in the street corner cold and afraid and I thought I'll walk back to that stinking AA club. I'd been 86th out of there a couple weeks before for some trouble I'd made. But I walked 71 blocks in the rain. And I thought, I'll have to do what I did in Texas one time. One time I directed a grand opera at the University of Texas. And when that was over, I drank so badly that they put me in the Texas State Insane Asylum, finally as a suicide. And the only way I beat that nut house was by pretending to be an alcoholic and getting on their alcoholic treatment program, rather than being in the psychiatric ward where I was. So I thought, I'll have to pretend to be an alcoholic with these goddamn idiot AAs for a while till I can get a score together. I think if I could just get to Seattle, it'll be different. The next town, somewhere. And I hung around that AA club, and I was so desperate, I let these people intimidate me and make me take actions and do things that I never would have done if I'd have had any decency or pride. Because the only thing I had left, as far as I could see, was my intellectual integrity. And now I was selling that out to these goddamn idiots. And I took actions and I thought stunk and I had the worst motives and I did things and pretended. And I began to get well. I was doing something I had no idea of. Do you know what I was doing? I was doing what Roland did on a ship in Le Havre. I was surrendering little by little. Surrendering. Didn't intend to surrender, but that's what AA is about. You act differently and pretty soon you feel differently. Whatever the motives. And I finally stayed sober for a while. And I began to understand, finally, after a long time, what was wrong with me. And it saved my bacon to come to understand that just as I'd always suspected, alcohol never had been my problem. I always thought that set me aside. Alcohol is not my problem. And I came to understand in AA the simple statement. I want to say it slowly and clearly. Because my life continues to depend upon it, and if you are like me, your life will depend on it. I had to understand, if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And conversely, if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not alcohol. Doesn't that sound goofy and upside down, strange? But that's the premise of Alcoholics Anonymous. You say, of course it isn't. Yes, it is. I remember sitting 1963 in New York with Bill Wilson and told him what I felt. He said, yeah, that's right. That's what I feel too. You say, but of course alcohol is the problem. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out winners. And they don't. Hospitals turn out winners. Treatment centers turn out winners. Jails turn out winners. Not at all. The problem is something that sounds like alcohol. And we talk a lot of times in AA about drinking, but it isn't alcohol. It's something that we mistake for it. It is called alcoholism. What's the difference between alcohol and alcoholism? Well, let me explain something about that. A couple years ago, a group of psychiatrists and doctors asked me to come down to Orlando, Florida, to talk for an hour and a half to them on the difference between alcohol problems and alcoholism. And I felt kind of sheepish because I could tell them on the phone in 3 minutes, you know. But then I thought if I did that, I'd miss my trip to Epcot. So I went down and dazzled them. But I don't have to take an hour and a half to tell you. I can tell you in 30 seconds. The difference between alcohol problems and alcoholism is this. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking. In this strange thing called alcoholism, you will discover that stopping drinking has no significant effect except to gradually make you feel worse and worse and worse and more tense and more estranged and more alienated, and the holes come back until you can't stand it, and God damn it, you're sober and you can't stand it. And everybody knows that can't be an alcohol problem. My case is different. Little do they know that is the symptom of alcoholism. And one other symptom must be present. Alcohol has to have a special effect on you. You must be one of the 5 or 6% of people that in the history of mankind always gets this effect. What is this effect? Does it make you stay drunk all the time? No. Make you crazy? Some people do, some people don't. I see people die who've never been crazy once, and they're dying. What is this special effect? Alcohol has to have the ability to almost instantly fill the holes. Alcohol, I had no idea it was an unusual reaction, almost instantly alters my perception of how reality is. Alcohol almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening to me. Alcohol almost instantly fills my holes. And if it does that, it just about assures the fact that I must die drunk. Because when I get off drinking, it becomes untenable. The deadly curse of alcoholism is that sobriety cannot be made tenable. And that's why nearly everybody who has it dies from it. Now, that's why Dr. Jung, in 1931, told Roland, you know what he said? He said, you're either going to have to drink intermittently till you die or go mad, or else keep yourself voluntarily confined, or else have a spiritual experience. Now, you may think that's old-fashioned. I believe that to be absolutely true today. Every piece of data I've ever seen seems to substantiate it. But how can that be? I bet there isn't a person in this room who has had a true spiritual experience. Because only 1 in 1 million or 5 million have them. And yet there are people sober all over. How can that be? And it goes back to something in this book. In 1939, when this book was published, the 12 steps read exactly as they did were read tonight, with one exception. In 1939, edition 1, first printing, step 12 said, 12, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And when that came out, Bill's followers said, Bill, that's wrong. You are the only one that had a spiritual experience. We never did. And you had yours 3 years before you wrote the steps. So you didn't have them as a result of the steps. What is this? And they sat down, and a lot of scratching. And Bill talked to Dr. Bob a lot, and they talked to the groups a lot, and they finally came to a conclusion. Not exactly in these words, but I think it would be safe for our frame of reference to say it. They discovered something that no one had ever known before. That in a way that nobody can describe or understand, in the history of mankind, these 12 steps do something that nothing has ever been able to do for alcoholics before. They provide an incremental spiritual experience. Not the kind Bill Wilson had. But the kind we are familiar with. Oh, Jesus Christ. Make amends to that dirty son of a bitch. And today there are 1.5 million people sober. Probably there aren't two of them who had a spiritual experience as Dr. Jung understood it, but we have all had an incremental spiritual experience of one kind or another, or we would not be sober tonight. The trouble is, you have to maintain it. It isn't a constant once you get there. Bill Wilson had a true spiritual experience and was ready to pack it in after 6 months. So it's not surprising that if we don't take care of ourselves, we'll want to pack it in again, and some of us will. But if we maintain it, we stay there. But if this incremental spiritual experience is there and it's available and it doesn't cost anything, and despite what the treatment centers and hospitals tell you, their effectiveness is in direct proportion to their use of AA in their treatment. Nothing else has ever worked. Nothing else has ever worked on a continuing basis. Why don't people stay sober? Because I'm glad you have 12 steps that provide an incremental spiritual awakening. But my case is different. Incidentally, the second printing of this book, and all printing since, have changed the 12th step. It doesn't say having had a spiritual experience. It says having had a spiritual awakening, which is what we seek today. Today there's a lot of hassle around AA all over the world. Who should be allowed to be in AA? Can narcotics addicts attend AA? Can problems with gamblers addicts attend AA? Can cocaine addicts attend AA? Can overeaters attend AA? Isn't it truly all one problem that we can get together with? False. False. First of all, a good example of that is the Washingtonians, who in 1845 had 100,000 members, and among other things they did wrong, they attempted to embrace all the problems, and in 1848 they had no members. All 100,000 were drunk. That's one example. But let's go back to the real thing. Dr. Bob, everybody in the world, doctors, ministers, top religious people had been working on Dr. Bob, and he couldn't stay sober. And he wrote later, "When Bill talked to me, that was the first person I ever heard who was able to describe how I drank and how I felt." Old Bill D. up in that hospital in Akron. "Them two fellers never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked to me about their drinking. And they described me perfectly." What is AA about? No matter how you slice it, no matter what you call it, we get lost in the clouds sometimes, but the bottom line is not anniversaries or chips or birthday cakes or love or understanding. The bottom line that makes AA work is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to hopefully break down that wall of feeling different so they will try the only thing that has ever worked. Now, that is why we have traditions that deal with that. It doesn't mean if you're an alcoholic and a narcotic addict, you can come. You can be an alcoholic and an overeater and come. You can be an alcoholic and a cocaine addict and come. But if you are not an alcoholic, you miss the only thing that makes AA work. The identification that helps you feel less different. That is why, long before most of you ever came around, in my era, in 1959 in Los Angeles, a narcotics addict that I knew in AA founded Narcotics Anonymous so people could identify who had problems like he had. And in 1960, a guy, Sybil Willis's husband, Jim Willis, founded, he was an AA member, founded Gamblers Anonymous for people who had that problem, that obsession. Funny thing, he got so involved in Gamblers Anonymous, he stopped going to AA and he died drunk. And the people in Gamblers Anonymous don't care if he died drunk, he is their patron saint that saved their life. Funny irony. In 1961, some distraught problem eaters, three blocks from where I was living, formed Overeaters Anonymous. In fact, the first few meetings they had, AA's come over and I went over there and talked to them a lot because they had nobody staying on abstinence. And we just talking about emotional problems and what to look for. Eventually some of them began to make it. And now they take care of their own program. And a few years ago, Cocaine Anonymous was formed out in West Los Angeles. And it's sweeping the country because people can go there and hear someone else talk about what they're doing and how they're feeling and say, yes, that's like me. But what you and I've got to do is remember, unless we have some identification, you're not going to stay here very long and you're not going to do things that are very tough unless you can feel that person who's telling you to do it knows how you feel. That's why we do these things. This is a matter of debate. It isn't a matter of how dare they say that. That's just the nature of the illness. So, here we sit tonight. New Hope Group, 10 years anniversary. Good group. People from other groups here. People from other states here. Celebrating this anniversary. Taking it for granted. Who cares that Ebby saved our lives only because he wanted to stay out of the Vermont penitentiary and he never stayed sober much himself after that? Nobody cares much that Dr. Bob turned over his house to people who didn't stay sober and thereby you and I are sober. Well, yeah, that's all history. Who gives a crap about that, really? But what you and I better remember is this. You and I live in the only 1% of human history where there's a place to go. You just stop and think about that fact for a minute. Just stop and think to yourself on the way home, what would I do if there was no place for me to go? If there were no AA, what would I do? You think about that sometime. It'll send a shiver down your spine. It doesn't sound like much at an AA meeting, but just project, what the hell would you do? Go live with a cousin somewhere? Get away? Wind up crazy again? You and I live in the 1% of human history when there's a place to go. Unless we take certain incremental, spiritually growing steps, more than likely we will follow the prediction and get drunk again. Sitting in an AA meeting won't keep you sober indefinitely. It will for a while, but eventually you must do the same thing Roland was told by Dr. Jung. You must have some changes. Roland couldn't get them from Dr. Jung. Roland couldn't get them anywhere. You and I can get them every day. But they're so easy to get, we take them for granted and say, there must be something more complex. My case is different. What you better get is a sponsor who you cannot manipulate, and you better get active in AA. Not so you'll be wonderful, not so you'll become wonderful and holy, because no matter how hard you work the program, you never rise above human being. You will always have faults, and alcoholics are just like all other human beings. Our minds are in the stars while our feet are stuck in the ship. Just and we got to deal with that. That's why they said, don't get too hungry or angry or lonely or tired. Not because they're bad things, but they make things look different. When you're hungry, people get stupid. I don't know why, but they do. When you're angry, God wants you to kill them for their own good. When you are lonely, you happen to know they're all having fun, but nobody told you. When you're tired, they attack you. I've used this example many times. I will again. I go driving that freeway in the morning, driving out by the ocean where I live, down to Skid Row where I work. And I've been sober a long time, almost 29 years now, and I know how to act not tired. They're not going to find out from watching me. And I hum a little song. But they know I'm tired. Up around La Cienega, some old lady said, "See the boy in the blue car? He's exhausted. I'm going to cut that son of a bitch off." The thing, the difference that AA has done for me, it is no longer necessary for me to chase them past my exit. If I haven't caught them by 4th Street, I say, "Good flying, Red Baron, we'll meet again." When I do catch them, I can't do anything. I can give them a ray. A few months ago, a little girl almost put me into the overpass. Very nearly killed me. Jesus, I was close. And I got next to her, I'll tell you, and gave her a quadruple ray. And I suddenly looked at her. She's about 17. As old as one of my granddaughters. And same color hair. Looked quite like her. Blonde and sweet. And I thought, what would I do if my granddaughter Katie were in that car and some old grump like me was acting like a fool? Christ. I thought, what kind of a beast am I turning into? I changed my stuff. I smiled at her. And she went, oh. She almost went to visit my grandma right then. But there's a lot of that crap going on out there. All over. Crap heads float to the top in every corporation. Brown nosers yelp you out of position on the turn. All sorts of things. And yet you got to live comfortably. You can only do it by having a place to go and taking certain things to do. You and I live in 1% of the human history where it's possible to do it. Now what we got to do is remember somehow not to take it for granted. If I catch you taking it for granted, I will certainly tell you so. If you catch me taking it for granted, I hope to God you'll tell me. And so that when we get doing better and feeling better, we don't take it for granted. The end of the long form of the traditions. You ought to read those sometime if you haven't. They're really interesting. But the last phrase of the traditions always struck me. It always reminds me why I want to keep active in AA, even though things are going fine. It says, "This to the end, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all." Happy anniversary. Thank you.